please be advised that the opinions and views expressed by Richard Martin of Global Financial Investment Services, LLP, are entirely his own and do not necessarily represent the views of the company, its affiliates, or its officers. Any investments based on Richard Martin's comments are unsolicited by the company and are at the sole risk and prejudice of the listener and the investor.
Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. This is the Wake Up Call with your very own host, Richard Martin. And today is Monday, the 22nd of December, 2014. And this comes to you all the way from Singapore. Well, you know, there is hope in understanding what lies ahead of us. And there is hope in getting prepared. There are always people who don't like what they call spreading fear. I've been doing this since PRN started up in 2005, or was it 2004? I don't remember. I don't personally see myself as spreading fear. I'm just giving information. When a hurricane is approaching, it's not spreading fear to tell people to board up their windows. In fact, you might even save someone's life. If you're walking down the street and you see someone about to step out into the road in front of a bus, you warn that person to stay back. Well, the United States is about to be slammed by the hardest times ever experienced in its history. If you care about those around you, you should be sounding the alarm. My analysis of the global financial system has completely convinced me that an absolutely horrific economic collapse is in our future. But understanding what is happening helps me to help you make plans for the years ahead and work hard to prepare for what's coming. When you look back over history, the heroes you admire the most arose during times of great adversity and conflict. The years ahead can be a time of a great awakening for you, or they can seem like hell on earth. It depends on how you respond to your circumstances. There really is strength in knowledge. If people choose to remain ignorant, they will of necessity respond to the years ahead with fear, panic, and depression. The millions of people that have absolutely no idea what is coming and have made absolutely no preparations are going to be absolutely blindsided by the coming economic collapse. Just like in the 1930s, we are going to see people jumping out of windows and paying ill-advised visits to the medicine cabinet. Others will sink into a state of despair so deep that nobody will ever be able to shake them out of it. But you know, it doesn't have to be that way. Over the years, I've plied you with thousands of facts and statistics that prove that the U.S. economy is hurtling towards oblivion. If you believe I'm wrong, prove it to me. I work very hard to put out the most accurate information that I can lay my hands on. So if you can prove me wrong, I'm all ears, as Ross Perot would say. I will change my mind. But of course, that's not going to happen. As I say so often, anyone with half a brain should be able to see that we're living through the most devastating debt bubble in history. Anyone should be able to see that the two big to fail banks are being extraordinarily reckless with their derivatives and things. Who could possibly fail to see that America's formerly great manufacturing cities are being transformed into crime-infested hellholes? Surely it's obvious that the middle class is dying. Anyone should be able to see that the exact same patterns that led up to the great financial crisis of 2008 are happening again. After so many talks from my own shows and others like it, it must be abundantly clear by now to regular listeners that a nation simply cannot consume far more wealth than it produces indefinitely. At least, I think it's becoming clearer and clearer to most people that the incredibly foolish decisions made by politicians over several decades have placed the world on the road to utter disaster. So really, it doesn't have to take anyone special to do what I do. I'm just a watchman on the wall, sounding the alarm as well as I can. And you know, there really are lots of others doing the same thing. Unfortunately, though, people always have an excuse for not getting prepared. And it's actually very interesting. A not insignificant number of people even believe it's what they call anti-faith to suggest that people do something to help their families deal with the nightmare on the horizon. There seems to be a serious attitude that we should all just sit back and wait for God to do everything for us. Such people believe that it's an expression of lack of faith in the Almighty to try to preempt trouble and force an alternative course to that which destiny has mapped out for us. And I think a lot of people feel this way, even if they don't know it or won't admit it. I think it's subconscious. Otherwise, I cannot account for what seems like a willful attempt to avoid facing the future, despite all the evidence demanding that we do so. So that's why it's so incredibly important not to let someone else do your thinking for you. In America today, the average person watches 153 hours of television a month. In addition to that, they also spend countless hours watching movies, playing video games, listening to music, reading books, and surfing the internet. Most people don't realize that there are just six giant corporations that control almost all of that content, which, of course, makes them immensely powerful. These giant media corporations are constantly manipulating our attitudes, opinions, and beliefs. And at this point, most Americans seem quite content to remain plugged into the matrix and to allow corrupt corporate executives somewhere to do their thinking for them. I urge you to break free from that system. Do your own research and thinking. Don't take what I say or what anyone else says as truth without critically examining it for yourself. This can be difficult at first, because today's American young people are not trained to think critically. They're trained just to blindly accept whatever information the system feeds them. George Orwell once said that, quote unquote, during times of universal deceit, telling the truth becomes a revolutionary act. That perfectly describes the era that we are currently living in. So, I need to talk to you about what happened last week in terms of the sudden dramatic collapse in the price of oil, which appears to be an act of geopolitical warfare against Russia. The result could be trillions of dollars in oil derivative losses and the FDIC could be liable following repeal of key portions of the Dodd-Frank Act. Senator Elizabeth Warren charged Citigroup last week with, quote-unquote, holding government funding hostage to ram through its government bailout provision. At issue was a section in the omnibus budget bill repealing the Lincoln Amendment to the Dodd-Frank Act. Now, the Dodd-Frank Act had protected depositor funds by requiring banks to push out a portion of their derivatives business into non-FDIC-insured subsidiaries. Warren and Representative Maxine Walters came very close to killing the spending bill because of this provision. But the tide turned, according to Walters, when not only Jamie Dimon, CEO of J.P. Morgan Chase, but President Obama himself lobbied lawmakers to vote for the bill. It was not only a stunning about-face for the president, a total betrayal of the interests of ordinary Americans, but represented an apparent shift in position for the banks. Before Jamie Dimon intervened, it had been reported that the bailout provision was not a big deal for the banks and that they were not lobbying heavily for it, because it covered only a small portion of their derivatives. The preamble to the Dodd-Frank Act claims, quote-unquote, to protect the American taxpayer by ending bailouts. But it does this through bail-in, authorizing systemically important, too-big-to-fail banks to expropriate the assets of their creditors, including depositors. Remember, under the Lincoln Amendment, FDIC-insured banks were not allowed to put depositor funds at risk for their bets on derivatives. There are $280 trillion in derivatives primarily held by the too-big-to-fail banks that include J.P. Morgan Chase, Bank of America, Citigroup, and Wells Fargo. Although 95% of the too-big-to-fail derivative holdings are exempt as legitimate lending hedges, levering cheap money from the U.S. Federal Reserve into $10 trillion of derivative speculation is one of the too-big-to-fail banks' most profitable business activities. 5% of $280 trillion is $14 trillion in derivatives exposure, close to the size of the existing federal debt. $3.9 trillion of this speculation is on the price of commodities. Among the bank's most important commodities bets are oil derivatives. An oil derivative typically involves an oil producer who wants to lock in the price at a future date, and a counterparty, typically a bank, willing to pay that price in exchange for the opportunity to earn additional profits if the price goes above the contract rate. The downside is that the bank has to make up the loss if the price drops. The recent drop in the price of oil by over $50 a barrel, a drop of nearly 50% since June, was completely unanticipated and outside the predictions covered by the bank's computer models. The drop could cost the banks trillions of dollars in losses. And with the repeal of the Lincoln Amendment, taxpayers will be picking up the bill. Interest rate swaps compose 82% of the derivatives market. Interest rates are predictable and can be controlled since the Federal Reserve sets the prime rate. The Fed's mandate includes maintaining the stability of the banking system, which means protecting the interests of the largest banks. The Fed obliged after the 2008 credit crisis by dropping the prime rate nearly to zero, a major windfall for the derivative banks, and a major loss for their counterparties, including state and local governments. Manipulating markets anywhere is illegal, unless you are a central bank or a federal government, in which case you can apparently do it with impunity. In this case, the shocking $50 drop in the price of oil was not due merely to the forces of supply and demand, which are predictable and can be hedged against. According to an article by Larry Elliott in the UK Guardian entitled "Stakes Are High as US Plays the Oil Card Against Iran and Russia," the unanticipated drop was an act of geopolitical warfare administered by the Saudis. History, he says, is repeating itself. The fourfold increase in oil prices triggered by the embargo on exports organized by Saudi Arabia in response to the Yom Kippur War in 1973 showed how crude could be used as a diplomatic and economic weapon. Now, says Elliott, the oil card is being played to force prices lower. John Kerry, the U.S. Secretary of State, allegedly struck a deal with King Abdullah in September under which the Saudis would sell crude at below the prevailing market price. That would help explain why the price has been falling at a time when, given the turmoil in Iraq and Syria caused by Islamic State, it would normally have been rising. According to Middle East specialists, the Saudis want to put pressure on Iran and to force Moscow to weaken its support for the Assad regime in Syria. If the plan was to break the ruble, it worked. The ruble has dropped by more than 60% against the dollar since January. The derivatives banks will get killed if oil prices don't go back up soon. At least they would have been killed before the bailout ban was lifted. Now it seems that burden could fall on depositors and taxpayers. Did the Obama administration make a deal with the big derivatives banks to save them from Kerry's clandestine economic warfare at taxpayer expense? Whatever happened behind closed doors, the people will again be stuck with the tab. You will continue to be at the mercy of the biggest banks until depository banking is separated from speculative investment banking. No prizes for being right on this one, I'm afraid. So let me talk for a few minutes about the stock market. The extreme volatility is very dangerous because it indicates that the stock market is being used as a gambling parlor completely unrelated to the company stock shares underlying the market. The Bank of International Settlements, by the way, takes the same view as was reported in a dispatch on 8th of December. The drunken euphoria you've been hearing from analysts, which came after the parabolic 421-point surge in the Dow Jones Industrial Average, is a sign of just how dangerous the situation is. They don't seem to realize that if the Dow can go up 428 points in one day, then it can just as easily go down 428 points in one day. And with the S&P 500 price-earnings ratio at around the astronomically high 19, well above the historical level of 14, it's only a matter of time before the stock market bubble bursts. And that's exactly the kind of situation that triggers a panic. These swings are getting wider and wider, just as they did prior to the 1929 crash. Most people are blissfully unaware of this, but the stock market fell 90% following the 1929 panic. However, that didn't happen all in one day. It fell 13% on Black Monday, and then another 12% the next day, but then it gained back 17% on the following 2 days, so by the end of the week, people were wondering whether it wouldn't recover completely. but it kept relentlessly falling, and it only bottomed out in the summer of 1932, despite repeated interventions by the Fed and repeated claims by President Herbert Hoover that, quote-unquote, prosperity is just around the corner. It really shouldn't be called the crash of 1929, since the stock market didn't really crash in 1929. It should be called the panic of 1929, since after all this time, the day that America remembers is the day of the panic, October the 28th, 1929. That's how it'll happen again. These wild swings will keep increasing until one day the computerized trading computers, or algos as they are now called, will take over and produce some sort of flash crash. And a lot of people will lose a lot of money. That will be the panic that everyone remembers. Then the stock market might possibly partially recover and people will cross their fingers, but the worst will be yet to come. All right, ladies and gentlemen, it's info time, and let's start with the toll-free number at 888-874-4888. Again, that's 888-874-4888. If you would like to write to me, write your emails, please feel free, do so. I shall be standing by to take them, hopefully during the show itself. And the email address to write to is rm@gfawd.com. RM for Richard Martin at GFAWD for Global Financial Advisory Wealth Design .com. Once more, RM@GFAWD.com. And finally, my direct line in Sarasota, Florida, comes straight through to Singapore. It is area code 941-441-1685. And that's for you to call me with your personal issues that you would rather keep private. Feel free, please call me. We will discuss them, and life will go on. Once again, that is area code 941-441-1685. Well, let me talk about junk bonds for a few moments. I've never really discussed them at any great length, and I think they deserve a mention here. If you're not familiar with junk bonds, the concept is actually very simple. Corporations that don't have high credit ratings typically have to pay higher interest rates to borrow money. High-yield bonds are long-term IOUs issued by companies with shaky credit ratings. Just like credit card users, companies with poor credit must pay higher interest rates on loans than those with gold-plated credit histories. But in recent years, interest rates on junk bonds have gone down to ridiculously low levels. This is another bubble that was created by the Federal Reserve policies, and it is a colossal disaster waiting to happen. And unfortunately, there are already signs that this bubble is now beginning to burst. Back in June, the average junk bond yield was 3.9 percentage points higher than Treasury securities. The average energy junk bond yielded 3.91 percentage points higher than Treasuries. That spread has widened to 5.08 percentage points for junk bonds versus 7.86 percentage points for energy bonds, an indication of how worried investors are about default, particularly for small, highly indebted companies in the fracking business. Analysts are becoming concerned about this shift in junk bonds because we also saw this happen just before the great stock market crash of 2008. Josh Birnbaum correctly made a giant bet against subprime mortgages in 2007, and now he's doing the same thing with high-yield junk bonds. A recent New American article detailed the existence of panic in the air. According to Tim Gromatovich of Peritus Asset Management, who oversees a bond portfolio of $800 million, and I quote, "It's a mania. Anything that becomes a mania ends badly, and this is a mania." End of quote. Bill Gross used to run PIMCO's gigantic bond portfolio, and he now advises the Janus Capital Group. He explained that there's very little liquidity in junk bonds. "This is the language of a bond fund manager uses to tell people that no one is buying, everyone is selling." Gross's comment, "Everyone's trying to squeeze through a very small door. So there's not really much that I can see that could stop junk bonds from crashing. The price of oil going back up to $80 or more a barrel would go a long way to settling things back down. But that's not happening right now. The price of oil is down another $2 a barrel today, at $55.48 a barrel. And if the price of oil stays this low, junk bonds are going to keep crashing, in my opinion. And ladies and gentlemen, if junk bonds keep crashing, the stock market is almost certainly going to follow." Well, here comes word in support of my contention that Americans really do support war in overwhelming numbers. Not something that people want to admit, but something which is incontrovertibly true. Which is why whenever a president declares war, his popularity automatically shoots straight up, inevitably to fall thereafter, as America loses all the wars it fights. A new poll by the Washington Post reveals, as they put it, quote, "From moderate Democrats to white evangelicals, nearly every demographic group believes torture can be justified." End of quote. The Post says nearly, but they are being generous. Close scrutiny shows every group supports torture. Here's the question at hand. Looking ahead, do you feel that torture of suspected terrorists can often be justified, sometimes justified, rarely justified, or never justified? There is not a single group in any age, in any race, in any party, or in any religious affiliation where a majority says torture is always wrong. It's no wonder the CIA tortures. They have support at every level. No one objects until it's done to them or to their families. But by then it's too late. When it happens to them, no one will care. Very, very, very sad. Very sad, ladies and gentlemen. Very, very sad. All right, well, it's a little bit early, but I think we'll take our break right now. And so stand by, ladies and gentlemen. I'll be right back. All right, ladies and gentlemen, we're back. And as always, let's start off with a few emails. The first one coming from Kevin Sierra, who says, "Hi, Richard. Just wanted to let you know that the last email I received from you came on December the 14th. Also, haven't noticed anything in my spam folder. If you are busy or on holiday, I'm sorry to bother you. Best regards, Kevin Sierra, Newfoundland, New Jersey." Is that Newfoundland, Newfoundland? I know there's something wrong with my pronunciation. I apologize. Anyway, P.S. Maybe others have also mentioned this. I really count on your emails and the PRN articles to keep me grounded. You are an important part of my sanity maintenance strategy. Well, I'm very proud and pleased to know that I can help out here, Kevin. The reality is I've been unexpectedly, suddenly overwhelmed with business that has unfortunately taken away my attention from my emails, though I hope not from my radio shows. But I'm coming back into line with the emails now, so all should be well, Kevin. But I'll have another hiatus at the end of next month, so get prepared for some suspension of daily activity. All right. Well, then we come to Peter Gable, who says as follows. Hi, Richard. Firstly, I hope you have a great Christmas holiday period. I know your theme this year was war with China, but you haven't spoken in this recently to my recollection. I thought you'd be interested to know that John Pilger, the amazing documentary maker, is raising money from Crown Source for his latest documentary entitled The Coming War. You can check this out on his website, johnpilger.com. You might want to mention this to your listeners. Maybe they can help him. In 5 days, he's already raised 40% of the funds needed, and this is a message that everybody needs to wake up to. As usual, you are ahead of the herd. I see the markets continue to defy gravity this week, down and sharply up. The powers in control just don't want to let go just yet. I wonder what they're waiting for. They know it must end, I assume, but that may not be the case. Collective denial, perhaps? Yellen talking about return to full employment, finishing their buying program like a woman on a mad shopping spree, and no movement in interest rates for some time to come. All the while, consumers back off from shopping, but no mention of this except in passing from the media. Kafka comes to mind. To think that a few years ago, I used to listen and believe in what these talking heads used to say on TV. Regards, Peter Gable. Couldn't agree with you more, Peter. That's the way it seems to be turning out these days. Each man for himself. All right, then, finishing off with Steve Kruger, who has this to say. He says, great opening on conditions in Germany today. That was my piece of the comparison between the United States and Germany and Europe of last week. I seem to catch myself many times a year musing, just who the hell won World War II? Don't think it was us. Merry Christmas to all. We will straighten out the world next year. Best wishes. Steve Kruger. Oh, thank you, Steve. Perhaps you would be kind enough to enlighten me on how you propose to do this. I have not been informed, so I need to be brought up to date, don't I? Well, the US dollar will keep rising simply because the Fed has tapered QE, and much of what happened in global credit markets, especially in emerging markets, was based on cheap and easily available dollars. There's now $85 billion less of that each month than before the taper took it away in $10 billion monthly increments. This is not primarily government debt. It's corporate debt. But it's still huge. And it's not just kept emerging economies alive since 2008. It's given them the aura of growth, which, as I've said all along, was temporary and illusory, just like in the rest of the world. And since countries can't, or won't, let their major companies fail, down the line it becomes public debt. One major difference from the last emerging markets blow-up in the late 20th century is size. Emerging markets today are half the world economy, and they're about to be blown to smithereens. Sure, oil will play a part, but mostly it will be the dollar. Try to imagine what happens when you blow up half the global economy. The yield spread between high-grade emerging markets and U.S. AAA-rated corporate debt has jumped, almost doubling in less than 3 weeks, to the highest level since mid-2012. The issuance of emerging market corporate debt has risen sharply since the depths of the 2008-09 financial crisis. These volumes are very large indeed and now account for non-trivial portions of investors' and pension funds' portfolios worldwide. As a result, emerging markets corporations are now leveraged to the hilt, easily exceeding the 2008 highs. If investors end up rushing for the emerging markets exit, for whatever reason, with this unprecedented level of exposure, they might be bringing home much more than a bruised ego and an empty wallet. For one, European banks are hugely exposed to emerging markets. Any impairment to their books would likely make any new lending even more difficult at a time when there is already a dearth of non-government credit in Europe. And if emerging economies falter, where will the growth needed to repair Western government and private balance sheets come from? It used to be said that when the U.S. economy sneezes, the rest of the world catches a cold. Now it seems all we need is a hiccup in emerging markets. That's what you get when emerging markets are both half the global economy and they've accomplished that level of ultra-low U.S. Fed interest rates and ultra-high U.S. Fed credit accommodation. The U.S. Federal Reserve has pulled the trigger. Emerging markets must now brace for their ordeal by fire. They have collectively borrowed $5.7 trillion in U.S. dollars, a currency they cannot print and do not control. This hard currency debt has tripled in a decade, split between $3.1 trillion in bank loans and $2.6 trillion in bonds. It is comparable in scale and ratio terms to any of the biggest cross-border lending sprees of the past two centuries. Much of the debt was taken out at real interest rates of 1% on the implicit assumption that the Fed would continue to flood the world with liquidity for years to come. The borrowers are short dollars in trading parlance. They now face the margin call from hell as the global monetary hegemon pivots. The Fed dashed all lingering hopes for leniency last Wednesday. The pledge to keep a high degree of stimulus for a considerable time has gone, and so has the market's security blanket, or the Fed put, as it's called. Such tweaks of language have multiplied potency in a world of zero rates. Officials from the Bank of International Settlements say privately that developing countries may be just as vulnerable to a dollar shock as they were in the Fed tightening cycle of the late 1990s, which culminated in Russia's default and the East Asia crisis. The difference this time is that emerging markets have grown to be half the world economy. Their aggregate debt levels have reached a record 175% of GDP, up 30 percentage points since 2009. The slide can be self-feeding. Funds are forced to sell holdings if investors take fright and ask for their money back, shedding the good with the bad. PIMCO's emerging market corporate bond fund bled $237 million in November, and the pain is unlikely to stop as clients discover that 24% of its portfolio is in Russia. The Fed has already slashed its bond purchases to zero, withdrawing $85 billion of net stimulus each month. It's clearly itching to raise rates for the first time in 7 years. This is one reason why the dollar index has jumped 12% since May. According to Stephen Jen from SLJ Macro Partners, and I quote, "World finance is rotating on its axis. The stronger the U.S. boom, the worse it will be for those countries on the wrong side of the dollar. Emerging market currencies could melt down. There have been way too many cumulative capital flows into these markets in the past decade. Nothing they could do will stop potential outflows as long as the U.S. economy recovers." End of quote. Hold it there for a moment. I don't think it's the U.S. economy. Its recovery is fake. It's the U.S. dollar. This time, the threat doesn't come from insolvent states. They have learnt the lesson of the late 1990s. Most don't have dollar debts. But their companies and banks most certainly do. Some 70% of GDP in Russia, for example. This amounts to much the same thing in macroeconomic terms. As I said earlier, private debt morphs into state debt since governments cannot allow key pillars of their economies to collapse. These countries have, of course, built $9 trillion of foreign reserves, often the side effect of holding down their currencies to gain export share. This certainly provides a buffer. Yet the reserves cannot fruitfully be used in a recessionary crisis because sales of foreign bonds automatically entail monetary tightening. These reserves are a mirage. If you deploy them in such circumstances, you choke your own economy, and investors are counting on the European Central Bank to keep the world supplied with largesse as the Fed pulls back. Yet the ECB could not pick up the baton, even if it were to launch a blitz of quantitative easing, and there is no considerable consensus for action on such a commensurate scale. In fact, there's no consensus whatsoever. There's a major reset underway. We're watching in real time the end of the fake reality created by the central banks. And it's not going to be nice or feel nice. It's going to hurt. And the lower you are on the ladder, the more painful it will be. Be that globally, if you live in poorer countries, or domestically, if you belong to a poorer segment of the population where you are. In both senses, the poorest will be hit the hardest. Well, last week the Fed raised its projection for economic growth in a fit of its typical, though inexplicable, optimism. In September, it had projected that the U.S. economy would grow between 2 and 2.2% in 2014. Last week, it raised what it calls its central tendency to a growth of 2.3 to 2.4%. That type of pathetic economic growth is far below the ever-elusive escape velocity that Wall Street keeps promising without fail every year to justify sky-high stock valuations. But now reality is once again playing havoc with our already not very rosy scenarios. The service sector is now the dominant force in the U.S. economy, and it's taken another hit. Markets, services, PMI business activity index slumped in December to 53.6, down from 56.2 in November. It's now nearly 3 percentage points below the average over the last 2 years, and it's barely above the terrible growth rate in February, for which the polar vortex that covered much of the nation was amply blamed. The peak of the services PMI was in June. For From that point of maximum exuberance, it's been a constant downhill ride. There was no polar vortex to be seen in recent weeks, and yet you can see a massive plunge from November to December. Even if there were no polar vortices to blame, there were plenty of business reasons. Incoming new work was the lowest in 9 months, with some survey respondents indicating that, quote unquote, the economic outlook had weighed on client demand at the end of the year. The rate of job creation dropped to the lowest since April, with some respondents citing softer new business as a reason. The composite PMI, which combines the services PMI and the manufacturing PMI, dropped sharply from 56.1 in November to 53.8 in December, and has been on the same trajectory as the services PMI, with the peak in June followed by a downhill ride that culminated in a sudden plunge in December that left it below February's polar vortex low. The December swoon points to the weakest economic expansion since October 2013, when the economy was tangled up in the hoopla of the government shutdown. Market chief economist Chris Williamson explained it this way, and I quote, "The extent of the slowdown suggests that economic growth in the fourth quarter could come in below 2%. Which, with the exception of the downturn caused by adverse weather in the first quarter, would be the worst performance for 2 years. The slowdown is linked to weaker growth of new business as customers becoming increasingly worried about the economic outlook both at home and abroad, with the prospect of higher interest rates cooling demand alongside rising global geopolitical concerns. Across both manufacturing and services, new business grew in December at a pace well below the rates of expansion seen earlier in the year." End of quote. Job creation has also slowed sharply alongside the cooling of demand, and payroll numbers across both sectors showed the smallest rise for 8 months. Another bumper month of non-farm payroll growth looks unlikely in December, with private sector payroll growth unlikely to breach the 200,000 mark. But we live in a world where central banks have succeeded in surgically severing any link between economic reality and the stock markets. They now run on the fuel that central banks feed them. They cling to every word, every indication, however vague, that the free money will continue ad infinitum. And last week, the Fed loaded them up with fuel. It further distanced the theoretical and ever more quaint notion that monetary policy would someday be normalized around the world, and that markets would somehow have to figure out how to stand on their own feet. Central banks still aren't buying oil as part of their QE, and look what happened. There are other issues dogging the economy. November home sales plunged in California, led by a 20% dive in San Francisco, where prices soared 27% to ludicrous heights previously. Well, the gulf between rich and poor people in America has hit a new record. An analysis released last week by Pew Research Center finds that the wealth gap between the top 21% of families and everyone else is the widest since the Federal Reserve began collecting such income data 30 years ago. Last year, the median wealth of upper-income families was almost 7 times that of middle-income families and nearly 70 times that of lower-income families. Quoting the report, "Measured as the difference between the value of a family's assets, such as financial assets as well as home, car, and businesses, and debts, wealth is an important dimension of household well-being because it's a measure of a family's nest egg and can be used to sustain consumption during emergencies, for example, job layoffs, as well as provide income during retirement. The latest data reinforces the larger story of America's middle-class household wealth stagnation over the past three decades. The Great Recession destroyed a significant amount of middle-income and lower-income families' wealth, and the economic recovery has yet to be felt for them. End of quote. The findings follow another Pew analysis published last week, which finds that U.S. wealth inequalities along racial lines have dramatically worsened since the Great Recession, with the gap between white and black people at its highest in 25 years. According to that study, which also looks at Federal Reserve data in 2013, white household wealth was 13 times that of black households and 10 times that of Hispanic households. Well, Family Dollar went from 6,500 stores in 2008 to over 8,000 today. That's a 23% growth rate. This rate of growth is quickly outpacing population growth, suggesting that there is now a new core audience of shoppers looking for rock-bottom deals. There are over 46 million Americans receiving food stamps each month. That's an enormous group, and the so-called stock market recovery has done nothing to alleviate this. Dollar stores have also undergone a radical shift over the last decade. Dollar stores have traditionally been a place to move low-priced items that did poorly in other large outlets. But now they have producers creating items directly for their audience. There is also a massive amount of revenue coming in from food sales, suggesting the shift from want spending to need-based spending. This is rather telling. It's good to know that many families are being supported with enough to feed their families each month. However, it's also scary to realize that 46 Americans would be close to starving if food stamp assistance were not available. The elevated demand for food assistance and dollar stores is coming from the destruction of the middle class and the rise of the low-wage economics in the U.S. A large part of the job growth since the Great Recession has come from the low-wage service sector. Well, the BIS said 55% of collateralized debt obligations, or CDOs, now being issued are based on leveraged loans, an unprecedented level. This raises eyebrows because CDOs were pivotal in the 2008 crash. Actively in the leveraged loan markets even surpassed the levels recorded before the crisis. Average quarterly announcements during the year to end September 2014 were $250 billion, it said. Yun Song-shin, the BIS's head of research, said the world's central banks still hold over 60% of their reserves in dollars. This ratio has changed remarkably little in 40 years, but the overall level has soared from $1 trillion to $12 trillion just since 2000. Cross-border lending in dollars has tripled to $9 trillion in a decade. Some $7 trillion of this is entirely outside the American regulatory sphere. Neither a borrower nor a lender is a U.S. resident. The role that the U.S. dollar plays in debt contracts is very important. It is a global currency, and no other currency has this role, he said. The implication is that there is no lender of last resort standing behind trillions of offshore dollar bank transactions. This increases the risks of a chain reaction if it ever goes wrong. China's central bank has ample dollar reserves to bail out its companies, should it wish to do so, but the jury is out on Brazil, Russia, and other countries. This flaw in the global system may be tested as the Fed prepares to raise interest rates for the first time in 7 years. The Fed's new optimal control model suggests that rates may rise sooner and faster than markets expect. This has the makings of a global shock. The great unknown is whether the current cycle of Fed tightening will lead to the same sort of stress seen in the Latin American debt crisis in the early 1980s or the East Asia Russian crisis in the late 1990s. This time, governments have far less dollar debt, but corporate dollar debt has replaced it with mounting excesses in the non-bank bond markets. Emerging market bond issuance in dollars has jumped by $550 billion since 2009. The weak links may not be where we think they are. The new threat may lie in non-leveraged instruments by asset managers and pension funds funneling vast sums of excess capital around the world, especially into emerging markets. Ladies and gentlemen, this may not all be very clear to you, but I assure you it is profoundly serious and very, very grim indeed. The world is teetering on a knife edge here. By this time tomorrow, these markets could be in absolute turmoil. And nobody can say they will be, and nobody can say they won't. But what one can say with absolute certainty is that the situation is melting down internally, and that very soon now the entire system is going to unravel and implode in a manner absolutely unknown to anybody since time began. And with that, ladies and gentlemen, we come to the end of our show. I wish you an excellent week and a wonderful Christmas, and I'll be back on what we call Boxing Day, which is Friday, with another edition of The Wake Up Call. So until then, take care, enjoy yourselves, don't overeat and overdrink. Have fun. I'll talk to you then. Bye-bye.